our second hour, we have J.D. Doyle's Queer Music Heritage. In this month's program, J.D. plays music by and has interviews with Troy Walker. Troy Walker is one of the pioneers of GLBT music. He got his start in 1958 in Los Angeles in the club circuit and started recording in 1961. J.D. describes Troy Walker as a flamboyant entertainer who never compromised his style. But before that, in our first hour, Phyllis Fry and the case of Mickey Aragus, the transgender woman whose firefighter husband died, and then the legal problems that resulted. And then on News Wrap tonight, the U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a stay of enforcement last week until at least December for District Judge Vaughn Walker's ruling, which found that California's Proposition 8 is a violation of the U.S. Constitution. The stay means that same-sex couples still cannot get married in California. Now, the legal team behind the challenge to Prop 8 has filed a motion to demand that Prop 8 supporters pay legal costs if the measure is ultimately found to be unconstitutional. And Mexico City's mayor has sued Guadalajara's Roman Catholic cardinal for defamation after the cleric claimed that the mayor had bribed the High Court in Mexico to secure recent marriage equality rulings in that country. And that's followed by the feature segment of This Way Out, which tonight is the story of Val Eastwood, a trailblazing lesbian who created a haven for LGBT people in the middle of the uptight 1950s downtown Melbourne.
Well, that's good.
Yes, and you probably haven't heard my voice in a little while.
Welcome back, Jack.
I'm glad to be back. I had some health problems, and I was recovering, and I also took some time, took some liberty. And I just want to thank everybody else here in the group who pulled together and put together some really good radio shows and planned the shows and still let me back in the door.
We had a good leader.
I do want to sort of veer off the subject just for a second here. There's a fabulous new movie that's playing at the River Oaks called Mal's Last Dancer. And it's not necessarily GLBT, although if you watch it, you will see some, you know, elements there. But it's based on a true story, and a good part of the movie is in Houston, which is really sort of neat to see. Just check it out if you'd like. A bunch of stuff going on in the community, so keep listening to our show and After Hours so that you know what's going on. We appreciate everybody who pledged to KPFT in the last
mini
marathon.
Yes, thank you very much.
It helps keep the station alive and going, and it's always important when you see what's going on the other media sources that don't bring you what's really going on. So with all of that...
We don't have a line lit up, so, okay.
Well, that will be soon.
Yes.
So... certainly, I have been keeping busy. I'd like to be doing more community work, but just been busy being out in the community doing other stuff, which I really enjoy doing. What have you been up to?
Well, I've been doing other things. One sticking point that I have, and many of you know, and I've talked about it, is that I've done a lot of work in the film industry and the TV industry over the years, in production a lot, and commercials and the like, but... This fall, there's a TV program called Lone Star that's coming into the fall lineup. And it is set in Houston, Texas. And the interesting thing is that the producers of that show came to Houston to produce it here. Obviously, they wanted the backgrounds and the like. But due to the ineptitude of the Houston Film Commission, it's in Dallas. They're shooting based in Houston, and they're shooting it in Dallas.
Well, that's sort of unfortunate.
Well, but that's just my two bits worth. I would throw that out there. Guys, call up the Film Commission and ask them what the heck they've been doing for a while. Are we still having troubles on the phone?
Well, I guess we could go it this way out right now and see if we can establish our interview a little bit later on in the show.
So he's holding me in his arms, and he's giving me sweet little kisses, And he's telling me he'll never harm me. And he's whispering how wonderful this is. And I tell him that I love him. And I tell him I'll be true. And I've said these things to other boys, but right now the old words feel so new. And I ask him, how did I get so lucky? I didn't even have to try. I'm just some guy. And he's smiling like he means it. And he's stretched out on his back. And he's telling me now that he loves me. For the fifth or the sixth time, I can't keep track. And I watch his eyes as they shine. Run my fingers through his hair. And I touch his chest where his heart is. And I tell him I find safe haven there. And I ask him, how did you get to be so sweet and so kind? So sweet and so kind. I don't know, he says, I'm nothing special. I'm just some guy. Your heart is so big, and your mind's so alive. Your mind's so alive. You have passion and freedom and vision and drive. You have so much to give, and you give it with care. You have helped me to heal, and there's no. His fingertips over my skin, and I'm happier now than I've ever been. And I'm hoping this feeling won't die. And if he says he's just some guy, that's fine. The truth is, he's mine. My sweetheart, my love, sent down from the sky, sent down from the sky.
Was Anthony Rapp from the year 2000 and his album Look Around, the name of the song Just Some Guy. This is Queer Voices.
And this is Jennifer Renee.
And Jack Falinski.
And we have on our phone Phyllis Randolph Fry. Some of you may have recognized that name. An accomplished engineer, a distinguished local attorney, and a dear friend. Phyllis, are you there?
Well, y'all are dear friends, too, and it's just such a delight to be here with my good friends.
Well, and Phyllis, I am so proud to that op-ed piece that was in the paper last week was just fabulous in the Chronicle.
Well, you know, I was very humbled by it because I have had things written about me,
yeah,
and I've been honored, but for the editorial board to make me one of their editorials, not, you know, an op-ed, but an actual editorial.
Right, exactly, right, yes.
Blew me away.
Yes, well, congratulations.
Well, it was well-deserved.
And didn't you love what Maria Gonzalez wrote and got printed up in Sundays?
I was going to ask you about that. What were your thoughts on that?
Oh, it was wonderful. Hey, you know, people who get the newspaper through the internet, they miss having a newspaper in their hands.
Yes, yes, yes.
And on Sunday morning, if you can imagine, the Sunday paper, the biggest paper of the week, and the editorial pages are four pages instead of two or just one, and you open it up, and on the right-hand side, and the right-hand page is always the page that is most fought over, and on the right-hand page, fully half of the column inches were devoted to all of the formatting and photographs and text and everything else that went into Maria Gonzalez's article about how people who are so homophobic are just bending the law and twisting it into craziness to oppose same-sex marriage. And she got half of the column inches of that page. Can you imagine? It was just gorgeous.
Well, and, you know, that's one thing to tout about actually having the physical paper. Not everything is on the web, and sometimes you miss things on the web because you don't scan it like you scan a newspaper. And I guess, you know, those of us who are a little bit older are used to that, having that physical newspaper, and it's really great to have it.
Yeah, I was very pleased. So what's up?
Well, also, just for my two bits on that, you know, talking about newspapers as opposed on the web, because I do a lot of reading on articles on the web, especially national stuff, but on Sunday morning, picking up the paper, or any morning for that matter, and picking up the paper, holding it in your hands, there's a certain tangibility about that that makes it that much more important to you when you read something like what I read of Maria Gonzalez's editorial or op-ed in Sunday's paper.
Yeah, it was great.
Well, I would like to obviously segueing into what she wrote on that and what's been written is the case of Nikki Aragoose.
Yeah.
There, you know, it was in the paper, it was everywhere for a few weeks, and then it's sort of off the radar right now. And now that things are a little quieter, you know, what was it? What is it all about? Because there are many people, it was sort of a splash, and you know, you heard all the wrong things. I personally, watching on television some of the terrible, hateful things that the family of the firefighter, Thomas Aragoose, were saying.
Yeah.
And it was, for me personally, as a trans person, it was abhorrent.
Yeah.
And that gave a different picture to really what's going on. And maybe you can sort of put some light on what's going on.
Well, I'll be brief yet as comprehensive as I can. But for anyone who wants more detail, if they will go to www.tgctr.org, that's the transgender center.org, tgctr.org, Kristen Williams, who's the executive director of the Transgender Foundation of America, has done a brilliant job with Facebook and with all these other social media things, putting up stuff and doing articles and covering this so that you can get the whole story. Basically, what it is that Nikki Aragoose is a post-surgical transsexual, male to female, and she has been in the Houston area for a long time. As a matter of fact, she worked for a number of years on the staff of Outsmart magazine, and she met Thomas Aragoose, and they fell in love, and they moved in together sometime in 2007. And then on, I think it was August of 2008, they went through a ceremonial wedding with a cake and the church and the minister and the whole nine yards. And then in October of 2008, she went to Trinidad, Colorado, to see Dr. Marcy Bowers and have her genital corrective surgery, so that when she came back, she had, as Oprah Winfrey would call it, she had a vajayjay. She and Thomas continued to live and love and do all the things that married couples do. Sometimes get a little angry with each other. Most of the time, enjoy each other and be playful, work, try to do the things they do. Thomas had two children by a previous marriage. And so from time to time, as was his due, he would get custody or visitation or whatever of the kids, and he and Nikki and the two kids, you know, really bonded well. Then July the 3rd of this year, there was a big fire in the Wharton area. I think it was a neighboring county, I'm not sure, at a big egg farm. And in as a result of the fire, Thomas died. And several days later, they buried him. Nikki, as the widow, was there, and she was presented with his service revolver and his badge. And about two or three days after that, Thomas's mother and the mother of Thomas's two boys came after Nikki with a vengeance. Because she was transgendered. And I first heard about it on a Sunday. I don't remember the date, but it was about 6 or 7 weeks ago on a Sunday afternoon as I was checking email for the last time before Monday. I saw a couple of people had sent me, "Have you heard about this?" And I looked at it and I thought, "Oh, okay. Well, we'll see if there's anything in the Chronicle tomorrow, the newspaper." And sure enough, on the front page of Section B was a big article about it. And that later that day, she called my law firm and hired us to represent her and against all of the charges. Essentially, what they and their lawyers have said is that there's money that is coming from various benefits that go with being a firefighter. And obviously by law, whenever someone dies without a will, and Thomas died without a will, by law a portion automatically goes to the children, and that is if there is a wife. And if there's a wife, the wife is entitled to a certain portion, and this is all fixed by law. But if there is no wife, then the children get it all. Nikki never has had a claim, never has forced a claim, never has asserted a claim against the portion that is due the children. The fight has been over if Nikki is going to get hers, or if the administrators, the people who have control over the children, are going to get all of it. And that's really what the fight is all about. Guess what? Money.
It always seems to be, when you boil it down, that's what it's about.
And they're saying that under the 1999 law, case law called Littleton v. Prying, that came out of San Antonio, they're saying that using that precedent, that Nikki is still legally a vaginaed male, and therefore, to prevent same-sex marriage, that this vaginaed male and her husband, a penis male, were a same-sex couple and therefore never were married. And that goes back to Littleton, because essentially the same thing happened with Christy Lee Littleton. Her husband died of an alleged medical malpractice, and she sued as the surviving spouse, and through a bending of the law to protect the world from the evils of same-sex marriage, Christy Lee was pronounced to have been a legally vaginaed male, and the court said that for the purposes of marriage, sex cannot be legally changed. And, of course, that case was also about money. It was about insurance money.
Right. Now, didn't the state of Texas address this as far as sex change?
Yes, actually.
The legislature in the state of Texas actually passed legislation
yes.
around this.
Yes, the Littleton court begged the legislature to do something about this, and the legislature had not yet, and so the Littleton court wrote what it wrote, stupid as it is. But finally, in 2009, and we think it's because of the fact that more and more transgenders are coming out of the closet, and more legislators know transgendered people, so we're not a big mystery, and also because more and more county clerks were being presented with evidence of sex change, surgical sex change, in the application for marriage licenses, and weren't sure what to do with it, that in 2009... Section 2.005 of the Family Code was amended, and that section of the Family Code addresses identification, proof of identification age to get a marriage license for a formal marriage. And
recognized by the state of Texas.
Yeah.
Okay.
Number 8 is proof of a sex change. And if you look at the legislative history, we got a Republican representative in a Republican House of Representatives, a Republican Senate, and a Republican governor. And the bill went through a House committee, and after it went through the House committee, it was amended to not only add the language that we're discussing, but to add 19 categories of identification that could be used. And then there was no dissension. It was put on the consent calendar, and it was passed without any dissent. Then it went to the Texas Senate, where it had the opportunity, with all of the amendments, including ours, to be presented and discussed in hearing. There was no dissent in hearing. There was no dissent in the committee. It went on the Senate's version of a consent calendar, passed with no opposition, was signed by the Republican governor. And it's our position that the Texas legislature, because it now recognizes in the statute that sex change can be proof of identity with respect to getting a marriage license, that unlike Littleton, that said sex cannot be legally changed for the purposes of marriage, the legislature has now said sex can be legally changed for the purposes of marriage. And that's our argument. Now, the other side is saying, well, all that means is that someone like Nikki or someone like Christy the Littleton can present evidence of a sex change, and that will allow them, as transgendered women, to marry another woman. And again, they're basing their argument on trying to prevent same-sex marriage by letting these two people who have vajayjays get married because one was born with a vajayjay and the other one wasn't born with a vajayjay. I mean, it's just dumber than
a stick, right?
Yeah.
Okay. For everybody listening in, we're talking with Phyllis Randolph Fry, distinguished local attorney, and we're discussing the Nikki Aragoose case currently ongoing. Well, Phyllis, okay, you've sort of laid out the case. What is it, as a community, we can do to help out?
Well, you can contact, you can go to the TGCTR.org website, learn more about the case, and there are definite links where you can donate money. Nikki doesn't have a job, and right now my law firm is pretty much operating on everybody is having to carry a caseload to bring in the money to pay their own personal rent and buy their own personal groceries and keep the law firm alive while we're working this case and there's no money coming in.
Okay. Like I said earlier, and I preface this, that, you know, it's sort of gone low profile. It's sort of quieted down. Why hasn't there been any more, or should there be any more national attention? Because this does have national ramifications.
Well, yeah, I vented on that yesterday. I sent out a filibuster.
I read the filibuster. Yeah, that's what prompted the question. But, you know, realistically, what can and do we really want a lot of spotlight placed on this case?
Well, the spotlight's going to be there regardless. As a matter of fact, Darrell Steadley, who is one of the partners in our law firm, and he is the lead attorney in this litigation, he and Nikki and attorneys from the other side are going to be interviewed tomorrow. 2020 is in town, and they're going to set up tomorrow morning and start filming first at our law office. Then they're going to go out to the other places because they're going to put a show together. And it's not going to go away, and it's going to continue. Every time there is a hearing, there is a newspaper article. Right now, we're in that part of a lawsuit that's called discovery, and essentially one side or the other sends messages to one side or the other saying, you know, we want these documents, we want these records, we want to know if these things are true or false. And so we're going through that part of civil litigation that to the outside person appears to be very boring, but it is the nuts and bolts of what makes a civil lawsuit work.
Well, one thing, and to go back to my question, organizations, national organizations around the country, or either their local constituents or components in their local community, what can they do to help? I mean, you know, do we make statements? Do they, what is it? Because there are a lot of organizations that are sort of quiet right now. And
yeah, and it's made me mad because they're all into the Prop 8 thing out on the West Coast, or they're all into the DOMA thing on the East Coast. And every time I hear on television any of them speak about same-sex marriage, they're always talking about lesbian same-sex marriage and gay same-sex marriage, and they never bother to mention the fact that, you know, transgenders continue to get the shaft on marriage, and it's over the same-sex marriage fight. Yeah. And so this morning, for those of y'all who don't know me or aren't familiar, I have generated over the last 15 years a rather large email list that's been compiled of with people I've communicated with over the last 15 years, and it's I call it the filibuster, and it's an e-blast. It's not a blog. It's just an e-blast. And sometimes if things are going on nationally or locally, I might send it out once or twice a week, and sometimes if things are slow, I might send it out once a month. But yesterday I sent one out, and I pretty much blasted the national leaders and the national big bucks, lesbian and gay people, because it seems like everything is focusing on the West Coast Prop 8 or the East Coast DOMA fight, but because we got a same-sex fight here in Texas, and it's a tranny.
Phyllis, we're out of time. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Thanks.
That's what it was.
Yeah. Phyllis, give us that those website again before we close.
TGCTR.org. Or you can just Google Transgender Foundation of America.
Thank you. We've been talking with Phyllis Fry, distinguished attorney here in Houston, Texas. And this is Queer Voices.
Hi, I'm Deb Schachter. I was one of the many who did what they could to return Pacifica to its mission, and I served as board chair during those first tumultuous years. I continued to serve until I was term limited. In this time, I've seen the board mature, become able to discuss differences without acrimony, and contribute to the station in productive ways. During my year off, I served on the Governance Committee as its secretary. We are now involved in the rewriting of the bylaws. It's an important and a difficult task. We need an active board who sees their work as enlarging our listenership, finding immediate funds, as well as ongoing funding to preserve both the network and the archives. We need people who see the importance of our affiliates and who will support them. We need board members who will thoughtfully support management. I am such a person. Please give me your vote to continue to serve. Deb Shafto.
This candidate statement is property of the author only and not KPFT or Pacifica. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, 89.5 in Galveston.
This is local station board candidate David Stahl. As a listener member, I know the power of KPFT as a platform for free speech. I enjoy our diversity of music and the open dialogue. I applaud our locally produced programs and talented hosts, and I value programming that's free of corporate advertising. As a member like you, I want to do more to support our community radio, and with your help, I can. You can put my proven activist skills and experience to work for KPFT. Let me join our team of outstanding board members to ensure KPFT remains on the air for another 40 years, fulfilling its mission as Radio for Peace. Please put David Stahl at the top of your ballot, and let's work together to keep the 90 mighty.
This candidate statement is property of the author only and not KPFT or Pacifica. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, 89.5 in Galveston.
Renowned investigative reporter Eric Schlosser, author of Fast Food Nation, The Dark Side of the All-American Meal, will appear at the Progressive Forum Thursday, September 30th at the Wortham Center. Information and tickets are available at progressiveforumhouston.org. The event is produced in association with Urban Harvest. Eric Schlosser's Fast Food Nation helped start a revolution in the way Americans think about what they eat. Eric Schlosser also co-produced the Oscar-nominated documentary Food Incorporated, a fierce indictment of our industrialized food agriculture system and the consequences for our health, environment, and worker rights. Don't miss Eric Schlosser at the Wortham Center. Tickets and information are at progressiveforumhouston.org. That's progressiveforumhouston.org. This is Pacifica Radio, KPFT, Houston, Texas.
The only way to have a truly fair election is if everyone votes. Get involved and make your vote count. Ballots for the 2010 local station board were mailed the week of August 15th. A separate mailing that includes information on all the candidates will be mailed the week of August 22nd. Tune in to KPFT every morning from August 23rd to August 27th from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. and hear the candidates speak about their ideas for KPFT. Join us on Sunday, August 29th from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. for the first of two community candidate forums. Both will be located at the Houston Institute for Culture at 708C Telephone Road. For more details, go to www.kpft.org. Keep KPFT healthy and thriving. Vote.
Recording history for lesbian and gays is important because it's really important to just understand how different it was for earlier generations and to see that even within conservative time periods, there's people who act outside the square and get away with it. The thing about Bell's Coffee Shop was that it was a public space, which meant that women could find other women. And it was also, it was known to be lesbian gay, but it was also, it wasn't like going to St Kilda and being pulled over by the cops.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Gay and Lesbian Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. A U.S. appeals court leaves California couples waiting at the altar, Germany's registered partners win inheritance rights, and fond memories of a liberated lesbian's cafe in 1950s Australia. All that and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
Sherry Lund.
And I'm Greg Gordon.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 21st, 2010. The 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals on August 16th blocked any same-gender marriages from taking place in California for now, and most likely for at least the rest of this year. A three-judge panel assigned to rule on all emergency motions extended a temporary stay of District Judge Vaughn Walker's August 4th ruling that found Proposition 8 in violation of the U.S. Constitution. The court formally accepted an appeal of that ruling by the proponents of the state's marriage equality ban. Three other judges of the Ninth Circuit will initially hear the case the week of December 6th. In what was considered a fast-tracking of the case, the court established an expedited schedule for submissions by the attorneys. But Jennifer Pizer, director of Lambda Legal's Marriage Project, wondered why the Ninth Circuit failed to apply the standard test for when a stay should be ordered. It requires an appellant to prove a strong likelihood of winning on appeal and proof that the appellant would suffer irreparable harm without a stay. Judge Walker had ruled that Prop 8 proponents failed to meet those standards. Many others also wondered why the appeals court's three-judge panel failed to offer any justification for its decision to extend the stay.
The only specific issue the judges did raise was whether or not the proponents of the ban can appeal Judge Walker's district court decision. Like Walker, the appeals court questioned the defendant intervener's legal standing to appeal under previous U.S. Supreme Court interpretations of the federal constitution's Article 3, which determined that only a state can defend its laws in court. The actual defendants in the case, California's Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger and Attorney General Jerry Brown, have refused to defend Prop 8. The defendant interveners who stepped in to support the measure represent the same people who put Prop 8 on the November 2008 ballot in the first place when voters chose to overturn the state Supreme Court's marriage equality ruling. If the Ninth Circuit rules that the proponents have standing and goes on to consider the federal constitutionality of Prop 8, it would not be expected to issue a decision until sometime in early 2011. The losing side can file a challenge to any appeals court ruling with the U.S. Supreme Court.
The Ninth Circuit must also decide if Imperial County has standing to file its separate appeal of Judge Walker's ruling. 70% of the voters in that California county, located in the state's southeast corner bordering Arizona and Mexico, supported the measure. Its Board of Supervisors argued in their filing that because the county issues marriage licenses, it has standing as a governmental body to appeal the ruling that the defender interveners might not have. Advocates for Faith and Freedom, a self-identified Christian legal group, is representing the county for free.
In a proactive move to counter claims by Prop 8 backers that marriage equality would impinge on religious freedom, openly gay state Senator Mark Leno has sponsored the Civil Marriage Religious Freedom Act in the California legislature. It guarantees that clergy cannot be forced to perform any marriage that is contrary to the tenets of their faith. The bill also protects religious institutions from losing their tax-exempt status for refusing to perform any marriage and deepens the distinction in state law between religious and civil marriage by defining the latter as a civil contract that requires a state-issued marriage license. The bill already passed in the state Senate and was approved in the Assembly this week by a vote of 46 to 25. It now returns to the Senate floor for a concurrent vote before being sent to Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger for his expected signature.
Meanwhile, Theodore Olson and Ted Boyce, the high-profile attorneys who led the challenge to Proposition 8, have included in their filing to the Ninth Circuit a motion asking that the measure's proponents be made to pay their legal costs if Prop 8 loses on appeal. The Olson-Boyce team hasn't disclosed how much that's been, though the organization funding the suit, the American Foundation for Equal Rights, has in recent weeks appealed for donations as the case moves to the Ninth Circuit.
Elsewhere, Mexico's Supreme Court this week affirmed by a 9-2 vote the adoption rights of lesbian and gay couples in the nation's capital city. The decision capped its earlier rulings this month that the marriage equality law passed in Mexico City in March was itself constitutional and that the civil marriages of same-gender couples celebrated there must be recognized in each of the country's 31 states. Mexico City Mayor Marcela Ebrard also filed a defamation lawsuit lawsuit against a Roman Catholic cardinal who claimed that Ebrard bribed Supreme Court justices to secure the equality rulings. A spokesperson for the church told reporters this week that Guadalajara Cardinal Juan Sandoval Iniguez has specific proof to back up his charges, but he would only reveal it in court as evidence. The Supreme Court has also condemned the accusations. The mayor said he was filing the lawsuit to defend his honor and to underscore the separation of church and state.
That concept seems to have also played a role in the United Kingdom this week, where its Charity Commission ruled that Catholic Care, a church-funded adoptions agency, must abide by provisions of the 2005 sexual orientation regulations. That legislation prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation in the provision of goods and services. A high court ruling in March denied the organization's request to amend its charitable objectives to avoid complying with those regulations. Catholic Care had argued that if it opened adoptions to gay and lesbian couples, it would lose its church funding and be forced to close. However, the Charity Commission determined that the agency had not shown enough evidence to be permitted to amend its objectives. In its decision, the commission also said that it was in children's best interests to have as wide a pool of potential adopters as possible, and noted that Catholic Care has only provided an average of 10 placements each year. It's the last church-supported adoptions agency to operate in the UK. All of the others have either closed or cut their ties with the church in order to comply with the sexual orientation regulations.
Germany's Federal Constitutional Court, that nation's highest court, ruled this week that same-gender couples in registered civil partnerships should have the same inheritance rights as heterosexual married couples. German civil partnerships, extended to lesbian and gay couples in 2001, offer limited rights compared to those of civil marriage. The High Court ruling came in a case filed by a gay man and a lesbian whose respective civilly registered partners had died in 2001 and 2002. They contested regulations that required them to pay inheritance taxes far higher than those for heterosexual married survivors. A civilly married spouse in Germany currently pays an inheritance tax of between 7 and 30%. A surviving same-gender partner in a civil partnership has had to pay between 17 and 50%. The court said that relevant tax laws dating back to 2001 were invalid. It set a deadline of December 31st for the parliament to produce retroactive legislation to rectify the unconstitutional disadvantage experienced by civilly registered lesbian and gay partners. Germany's Justice Minister Sabine Lutheiser-Schnauenberger told reporters late this week that she thinks same-gender partners should also be granted income tax breaks similar to those enjoyed by heterosexual married couples. She said the government shouldn't wait for a high court decision on that issue, which is pending.
Following up on our report last week, U.S. Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Victor Fehrenbach, believed to be the highest-ranking officer now being prosecuted under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, has won a temporary reprieve from the imminent discharge he said he's been expecting, a recommendation that he be fired even though he didn't tell military authorities that he's gay but was outed by a disgruntled civilian, was reportedly sent to the Secretary of the Air Force, the final step in the process, although an Air Force press release last week denied that. The U.S. Department of Justice, the Air Force, and the U.S. District Court for Idaho, where Fehrenbach's lawyers filed a motion to prevent his discharge, have reached an agreement that keeps the highly decorated combat pilot in the service until the court can hear his case. If the Air Force decides at any point to discharge Fehrenbach, who's about a year short of retirement, they must give his legal team 21 days to seek a preliminary injunction that would keep the lieutenant at his current desk job at a military base in Idaho, where he continues to serve with distinction and virtually universal support.
And finally, about 4,000 LGBT people and their supporters marched with pride in Tokyo on August 14th in the first such event in 3 years. Police said that the participants, many in flamboyant attire, waved rainbow flags and danced to blaring music on elaborately decorated trucks. Japan has no laws against homosexuality, but there are few openly lesbi-gay politicians, and public discussion of LGBT rights is a rarity. All of the crowd in the parade was its largest ever, it was a relatively small number in a city of almost 13 million people. Hideki Sunagawa, one of its organizers, told Reuters that coming out continues to be a challenge in traditionally conservative Japanese culture, and that enough staff couldn't be recruited to stage a successful Pride event in recent years. This year, for the first time ever, apart from the usual gay websites and bars, Sunagawa said, we also attracted big international sponsors, such as Google, Bank of America Merrill Lynch, and Citigroup. Many side events also took place in the city's Shinjuku district, which, according to Reuters, and despite a reticence in society to discuss issues of sexual orientation and gender, is home to at least 25 gay and lesbian bars.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 21st, 2010, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. Read the text of this week's News Wrap online at www.thiswayout.org.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon.
And I'm Sherry Lunn.
We'll hear about one woman who created a revolution in mid-20th century Australia after this salute to a woman who carried out a revolution in mid-18th century America.
Deborah Sampson, the first woman to join the Army as a man. Coming up now on The Rainbow Minute. Born into poverty in 1760, Deborah Sampson became an indentured servant at age 10. At 21, she felt a call to military duty. She disguised herself as a man named Robert Shurtleff, bound her breasts, and fooled her way past an army recruiter. Although teased by her military comrades for not having facial hair, she performed as well as the men did. During Revolutionary War skirmishes, Sampson received both sword and musket ball wounds, which she tended herself to keep her gender under wraps. Later, hospitalized with fever, the attending physician discovered her secret and made discreet arrangements for her honorable discharge in 1783. In 1804, after Paul Revere addressed Congress on her behalf, Deborah Sampson started receiving a U.S. pension for her brave military service. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Jeff Schultes.
Extra, extra, read all about it, extra.
Have you checked our website for the latest This Way Out update? For a review of recent programming and behind-the-scenes news about your favorite international LGBT radio show, just log on to www.thiswayout.org.
LGBT people and their allies in cities across Australia hit the streets for equal love rallies on August 14th. There's been an annual protest since the 2004 passage of federal legislation defining civil marriage as exclusively heterosexual. Organizers said about 1,000 people marched in Sydney. Activists counted 4,000 to 5,000 in Melbourne, although local media reports called it far less than that. Three same-gender couples staged symbolic wedding ceremonies in Brisbane, aided by between 600 and 1,000 loud and proud supporters. Hundreds marched in Adelaide to the office of lesbian federal cabinet minister Penny Wong, who's come under fire for towing her Labour Party's line against marriage equality. And about 600 rallied in Hobart, where pro-equality federal election candidates knocked down a symbolic wall of discrimination, displaying words like bigotry and inequality. No one from the country's moderate Labour or right-of-center Liberal parties made appearances at the rallies. Both of those two major parties oppose opening civil marriage to same-gender couples. But everywhere, rally speakers from the Greens and other minority parties called on the federal government to follow the lead of the Australian people. Public opinion polls consistently report majority support for full civil marriage rights for gays and lesbians. Australians went to the polls this week to choose between Prime Minister Julia Gillard's Labour Party and the Liberal Party led by Tony Abbott. No matter who wins, gay Green Party leader Bob Brown called on both major parties to allow its MPs a conscience vote on marriage equality legislation. He promised the Greens would introduce such a bill during the next parliamentary session, saying, "I think it would pass with flying colors." it's taken over half a century of LGBT pride and persistence to get to this place. 3CR-based Marion Prickett of Australia's community radio network program Women on the Line brings us the story of Val Eastwood, a lesbian who created a haven for LGBT people and other outcasts of the time, smack in the middle of uptight 1950s downtown Melbourne.
All you old-time queens, you sang the blues, tried to amuse. Here's how they pay the bill.
Yes, hell yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
The law stepped in and called it sin to have a little fun.
In 1951, homosexuality was a criminal offence throughout Australia. Robert Menzies had begun what would be an 18-year term as Prime Minister and had begun his mission to destroy the Communist Party. The pubs closed at 6 and few Aboriginal people had the right to vote. But it was in this climate that a 22-year-old dancer and former shop assistant, Val Eastwood, opened a coffee shop in Swanston Street, Melbourne. It would become a haven for gays, lesbians and Melbourne's bohemian misfits. Ruth Ford from the History Department at La Trobe University tells us more. Along the way, we'll hear some readings from the transcript of Val's oral history, recorded by Ruth and published in The Travelling Mind of Val Eastwood. If I was to transport myself back in time to 1951 and walk down Swanston Street and stumble into Val's cafe, what would I find when I got to the top of the stairs? Can you describe that?
Val, in her very stylish suit, looking really gorgeous. The decor of the coffee shop was really different to, tea rooms were standard in Melbourne at that time, but as Val says, very few people actually served coffee. You know, that was a European thing, and we're talking about not just, conservative in terms of homosexuality and anti-communism, but gender roles, but also in terms of, white Australia. I mean, we're talking about white Australia policy, and it's only European post-war migration is kind of starting. So to have a coffee shop with a European menu is also really different as well. But the other thing about it was just the music, and was also probably the first time there'd been a lesbian gay venue that wasn't just a bar or, people loved going there in terms of there was great music and you could actually hear other people talk and you weren't being harassed by, because the clientele included theatrical people. It wasn't as if it was like a pub where lesbian women were being bashed up by men because they were lesbian, and on male territory in a bar scene.
Sounds like it was a pretty extraordinary place in general in Melbourne at that time.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, probably the most important for lesbian and gay people because there was so little else. But certainly for theatrical people as well, they all went to Val's and loved it because it was just so different from what else was around conservative staid Melbourne.
There was never any friction or... It just was a very interesting clientele, consequently. People used to sit there all night talking and having heavy conversations, or terribly, particularly the boys, outdoing each other with their wonderful repartee, which they were very good at. So it was a very interesting, bright atmosphere, and it was a good thing that it happened. I think one of the nicest things that anyone ever said to me was a lovely man who became a dress designer finally and made beautiful clothes. When he used to come to the coffee lounge, he was only in his teens, must have been 18 or something, and he said to me years later, "You absolutely saved my life." Because, he said, it gave me a purpose. I would come home from the rotten job I had, and I would have a shower, and I'd get dressed up, and I would have somewhere that I could go where I just felt I was somebody. And he could be gay, not outrageously, just be himself. And he said, "You may not know it, but that goes for a lot of other people," which is true.
In the preface to The Travelling Mind of Val Eastwood, you write about meeting Val for the first time in 1995 when you interviewed her. What was she like in person?
Val was very, she was very forthright and, you could see that she had poise and enthusiasm and passion for life.
Would you say it's that poise and enthusiasm for life that let her get away with running this amazing coffee shop in the 1950s? I mean, how did she get away with it?
Well, obviously it is Val's amazing courage and audacity, as well as, you know, her humour that she could carry it off. But I think it's one of those things, isn't it, that, I mean, yes, it's the conservative 50s, but there's always spaces in repressive times, and one of those spaces was within theatre, and that was where Velvet come from, you know, the dancing company, near theatre, which was a communist theatre, and then opened a dance school. So theatre was a space in which, you know, cross-dressing was accepted and campness was accepted. So I think that was one of the few kind of liberating spaces in the 50s that gay people or lesbian people were accepted publicly, you know, which is different to what's happening in the bar scene where the police are harassing people. So, yes, absolutely, it was about Val's courage, but I think, you know, there was a space within that kind of theatrical world for something like that to happen.
What other spaces were there for gays and lesbians to mingle in at that time?
There was a bar scene, and obviously male homosexuality is criminalised, and there's 6 o'clock closing, and women can't drink in public bars. But, you know, there was a working class lesbian bar culture that was pretty rough, and they did get harassed by police. So, you know, middle class women, lesbians weren't going to go into those places because they would just be terrified that they'd be picked up by the police or their parents would be told or whatever. So the thing about Vel's Coffee Shop was that it was a public space, which meant that women could find other women, and it was also, it was known to be lesbian gay, but it was also, it wasn't like going to St Kilda and being pulled over by the cops.
We didn't have a telephone, never thought of putting the phone on, but we were opposite the town hall and the police department was there as well in those days, and if I ever did have trouble, which was never to do with gays, but the odd drunks who'd stagger up the stairs if I couldn't be rid of them, which I usually could, I'd give the nod to somebody to run over and get the cops, and they'd come and eject them. So they were very cooperative, which was unusual because at that same time they were raiding the gay parties, drag parties and things. Occasionally some of the boys, a couple of the boys, might turn up in drag, but it was very rare because it was too dangerous. You know, they never would be seen in public, and they should have been left alone because their parties, they were certainly being victimised by the police, but never at the coffee lounge, because after all, what were we doing?
You mentioned that Val was involved in the New Theatre, which was affiliated to the Communist Party. Did that reflect her politics, or was it simply a creative outlet?
No, I think for her it was a creative outlet. They approached her to dance and do some choreography. She never joined the Communist Party. She said that she was too liberal for that. But I think, yeah, I mean, it says something about stepping outside the square, doesn't it, that, you know, we're talking about a time when people in the Communist Party and New Theatre, you know, had files from ASIO and were under surveillance. People in it had to be courageous, so I guess that's another element of Val's courage, that she wasn't really worried about that. She was, you know, she was passionate about doing the dance in the theatre, and wasn't scared of, you know, having a record.
Did you get a sense from Val when you interviewed her of what her motivation for wanting to record her story was?
She wanted to write her own story, and obviously she's a fiction writer. I think she wanted to do it herself, because I'd certainly approached her years earlier and she hadn't responded. So I think there was that sense of doing her own story. But at that time, anyway, she changed her mind and agreed to be interviewed. But I think it was to pass on her story so that it wasn't lost, I guess.
What's the value in recording history in oral form?
Recording history for lesbian and gays is important because it's really important to just understand how different it was for earlier generations, and to see that even within conservative time periods there's people who act outside the square and get away with it, and that individuals can have a huge difference in changing things. In terms of why oral rather than written, when you sit down and write a polished story, you'll always polish it and get rid of all the contradictions and all those kind of things, whereas an oral story has much more complexity. Just the meanings that comes across through sound is different. You know, where people pause, where they hesitate. It's a very powerful medium, which I think can give you more of an insight into their subjectivity and their kind of shifting identity, whereas a written thing tends to be more fixed.
Val passed away in December 2009. How would you describe her legacy?
Oh, I think her legacy was, to be courageous. And, I mean, she was publicly visible at a time when most middle-class lesbians were very private about their lesbian identity, and she was not afraid of being seen to be who she was, so she expressed her lesbian identity visibly, both through her dress and through the operation of her coffee shop. So I think her legacy, as well as kind of the practical legacy of providing a public space for lesbians and camp men to socialise, it was also the legacy of being bold and visible about sexual identity and not being ashamed or hiding it. And I think the other legacy was also that, as well as, you know, 1950s Australia being fairly conservative in terms of gender roles for women and men, which Val obviously completely resisted by, you know, by starting up her own business for a start. I mean, you know, women couldn't even get loans at that time. But also, you know, she challenged the gender politics of the lesbian community as well. At that time, you know, a large part of lesbian subculture had very fixed gender roles in terms of, you know, you were butch or you were bitch. And Val played with gender. You know, like she wore a suit and had her hat and cane, but then she had lipstick as well. So she had a very, she dressed, you know, in a masculine style, but a very kind of theatrical style as well. And played with masculinity and femininity by mixing, you know, the lippy and the suit. Which, you know, I don't think, you know, probably occurred in lesbian communities until much, much later. So I think that was probably a first as well.
Dr. Ruth Ford of La Trobe University remembered lesbian pioneer Val Eastwood with Marion Prickett of Australia's Community Radio Network program, Women on the Line. Thanks for choosing This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Sherry Lund, Judd Proctor, and Brian Burns with Jeff Schultes and Marion Prickett from 3CR Melbourne's Community Radio Network show Women on the Line contributed program material. Thanks also to Frieda Worden. Billie Holiday and The Gossip performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out is funded by a grant from the Kicking Assets Fund of the Sides Foundation and by you. Thank you. Log on to thiswayout.org to add your support, listen to our podcasts, read the text of this week's news wrap, or subscribe to CDs of our programs. You can connect to our blog, Facebook page, and tweets there, and also find us on iTunes. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening. On WSMU North Dartmouth, Massachusetts, CKDU Halifax, Nova Scotia, KVSC St. Cloud, Minnesota, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.
This Way Out is heard every week as part of Queer Voices. You are listening to 90.1 FM KPFT. At 90.1 FM, this is KPFT Houston. Now, more of Queer Voices with Jack Belinsky and the entire Queer Voices crew.
Once again with you, though I dream in vain, in my heart there will remain my stardust melody, a memory of love's refrain, because my prayer. Yeah.
This is J.D. Doyle, and welcome to Queer Music Heritage. I took that piece, including Stardust and My Prayer, out of a longer medley from a 1965 album called Gazzaris Presents Troy Walker. And Troy Walker is the subject of my special feature interview this month. One thing that makes it special is that I love to share with you the actual voices of our pioneers, and this one started recording about 50 years ago, and he's still performing. Now, he never became a household name, but he's done a lot of music and worked with many people you do know, like Jerry Lee Lewis, Leon Russell, Timmy Euro, and has stories to tell about Johnny Ray, Cher, Phil Spector, among others. And he never compromised, in that he was a very flamboyant performer, and he did not tone down his style. L.A. in those years was a very cutthroat town, and Troy just tried to make his music amidst all that. And he was a quite popular performer up into the 80s, when he stepped back from the business for a while. I first played his music on one of my shows in 2004, and since then had been wishing I could track him down for an interview. That finally happened when I found mention of a recent performance and a person to actually ask for contact information. That turned out to be Johnny Whiteside, who happens to be the author of an excellent biography on Johnny Ray. He got me in touch with Troy, and I started the interview by asking him for a little about his growing up.
I grew up in Illinois, first part of my life, then we moved to Arizona, and I went to school there, pretty much high school.
And what landed you in Los Angeles?
Well, I went into the Air Force, and when I got out of the Air Force, I just wanted to come over here and decide what the hell my life was all about. So I came over to Hollywood and walked into a bar. And the guy asked me if I could sing. I told him I sang in high school. He shoved me a mic. I sang two songs, and the owner came over and asked me to come in every night and sing. And I was underage. But I came in anyway, and wound up singing ever since.
Who would you say your musical influences were?
Mine? Oh, wow. Well, the Platters, Jackie Wilson, Little Richard, a lot of the black groups when I was a kid. They weren't popular, but they were with me. We used to go in the alley and listen to them.
And when did you start going by Troy?
About the same time. I grabbed the name whenever I first hit Hollywood.
Can you describe your stage act back then?
Back then, well, it was never really an act. I just got up and sang, and I started regular singing, and thank goodness that was bought for the most part. When I got on stage, actually started getting, you know, I get whistled at, and because it wasn't my fault, I was, lack of a better way to put it, a little pretty boy. And so I'd get whistled at, and they'd sound off with some names and so forth, and I'd come back with some smart-ass remark.
So you were good at handling hecklers?
Yeah, I became good at it. I can't say I was good at it. I just always, I seemed to always have the audience on my side, you know. I played off of that. I get paid to be a jackass. Why are you here? You know, that sort of thing.
I've gotten the impression that your act was kind of a cross between Johnny Ray, Frankie Lane, Jackie Wilson, and Don Rickles.
I guess, yeah. Kind of, you know. To say that it was an act, I always kind of wondered about that, because it's not something that I, you know, polished or perfected. It's just what I did. I happened to have this range voice that I could do other voices, and then getting a little clever, you know.
I understand you became really good at doing impressions like Diana Ross, Johnny Mathis, Roy Orbison, Elvis, etc.
Yeah. To say that I was an impressionist, I don't think it's all that accurate, because what I did was I would take the hit song and affect the voice, and it would be just enough to make it work. It worked for me, you know. Dinah sang through her nose, you know. Johnny sang through the side of his mouth, and I watched them and I met them, and sort of picked up on it. I've never really thought that was all that great a thing. You know, other people did, but I didn't. I just kind of wove it into an act because I would do just a remember when, and I would go back and I would throw out Dinah's voice or Della Reese, you know, that sort of thing. Making up kind of a little story.
Mm-hmm. You'll hear an example of how he could imitate other voices when he describes this next recording.
I understand you have a bunch of 45s. I found a 45. I'm not sure it's you, though. It's called She's All Right and I'm Getting Hip.
I'll be damned. Yes, that's me.
It is? That's you?
That's me.
It doesn't sound quite like your other stuff.
No, it wouldn't sound like I. That was a pretty full arrangement. It kind of sounded like a Jackie Wilson tune, right?
Right. Yeah. But okay. But I knew you're famous for doing all kind of different voices, so I figured, well, maybe it's him.
That one was brought to me by one of Elvis's people. It was a good song. I recorded that, and the other side is, you reminded me, and I even forgot what the other side is. She's All Right, and I'm Getting Hip. Yeah, I wrote I'm Getting Hip. Yeah, again, that was something we were sitting in. And we threw together. They played it locally. I know that it was played. It was one of those things that you call in and you vote on it.
Right.
I think I won that thing, and then they played it for another week or something. I'm not really sure.
Billboard mentioned it in 1961.
61?
Yeah.
Whoa. That is way back there.
In March of 61... they wrote a review. Troy Walker turns in a swinging vocal on a bright hunk of material.
I'll be darned.
March 61.
That's the first I knew that it got written up. I didn't pay too much attention, as you see.
And here's a bit of both sides of that 1961 single, She's All Right and I'm Getting Hip. I switch songs at the sax break.
Played a lot of clubs, and some of these were long engagements, like for many months.
Oh yeah, I would do one nighters, and I would go for months on years, and a couple of them I would be there on two nights a week, you know, one night a week. But I was moving around all different clubs. I did that for years.
To think that you lied.
For those of you who need a reminder, or those too young to know, that was a little bit of the song Hurt from 1961, the biggest hit of an artist with a soaring voice, Timmy Euro. And that sets the stage for my next question.
I've read a number of places about your professional involvement with Timmy Euro in different accounts of why that didn't work. Can you fill me in on that?
I met Timmy. She came into where I was working in the valley, and from clear across the room, we started singing to each other. And we wound up a duet. We went to Vegas, played Vegas, and then they wanted a singer to do Dinah Washington's Hurt, her song, and they wanted a singer that sounded black. And so we were playing in Vegas, and they flew Timmy back here, and she cut Hurt, and I didn't know anything about it. And I came back into town, and suddenly there was a hit record playing on the radio. It's quite a story. It goes on to different things that happened, but we were signed with Liberty Records.
But you didn't record for Liberty.
I guess we did. We recorded, but they didn't do anything with it.
Right. They didn't release anything.
No.
Well, I would have loved to have heard a duet with you two.
It was something to hear. I'm sure there's tapes somewhere,
yeah.
But I wouldn't know where, you know, because they did record us. They recorded several things with us, but nothing ever came of it. Just suddenly, Clive Davis came in and got Timmy. I was just gone. They offered me some tunes that I just wasn't interested in, and I didn't know that there was a planned separation. And that all came as a surprise. Not a heartbreak I was glad for, you know, but it was a surprise.
A couple articles I've seen suggested that you were maybe too flamboyant for Liberty.
I'm sure I was too flamboyant for anybody at the time. I wasn't even flamboyant. I was really being just myself, and it worked for me. You know, I was small, for lack of a better way to put it, pretty face thing, and you know, I would get a lot of flack from that. It turned out to be good and bad. You know, I was no one ever made me aware that I was too much. All I got was, you know, praise and they're interested, but I was so busy working and just maintaining my status working that I didn't really deal with any of that other, you know, too much. But different people that I helped into the business went on and told me much later on that there were record companies, I guess, were scared of me. I was a little much, they thought, you know. But that was back whenever a lot of tongue-in-cheek, you know, nobody talked about nothing, you know.
Uh-huh. Another 45 I don't have, but I've seen it on the internet. Summertime and Midnight in Moscow.
Yeah, now that was recorded at the Interlude, which Gene Norman presents. That was his record, GNP. That was his record label.
Uh-huh.
And that was a cover. Midnight in Moscow came out, and he wanted a vocal. And the other side was Summertime. I remember doing that. And we did an up version of Summertime, I think. Yeah, and that was just me and three other musicians, I believe it was.
It's summertime. Living is easy. Fish are jumping. Don't you know your daddy's so rich? Ah, your mama, she's a looker. Hush, little baby. No, no, don't you cry. One of these mornings, you're gonna rise up singing. Wow, you're gonna spread your wings. Till that morning, there is nothing gonna harm you, no.
me standing by your side.
Summertime from 1962. That brings us up to Troy's first full album, which was called Troy Walker Live and was released around early 1964. From that album, here's the opening song, Sinner Man.
Sinner Man, where you gonna run to? Sinner Man, where you gonna run to? Sinner Man, tell me where you gonna run to? On that day, I run to the sea. Won't you hide me? I run to the sea. Won't you hide me? I run to the sea. Won't you hide me? Oh, on that day, the Lord said, "Send a man to see me boiling." The Lord said, "Send a man to see me boiling." Lord said, "Send a man to see me boiling." All on that day, Lord, won't you hide me, Lord? Lord, won't you hide me, Lord? Won't you hide me? Find me.
It's been widely reported that after the release of the live album, your career stalled because it contained the song Happiness is a Thing Called Joe. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, it was. They sent it back. It was sent back. High Fidelity, Richard Vaughn, told me that a man singing to a man, they weren't accepting, and he was getting a lot of flack, and so that kind of, I guess, died on the vine. And he said he got a lot of albums that were sent back because at the time it really stood out on the record. That was a big disappointment, but I didn't make a big thing of it because again, I was working, and the promise of whatever would happen in the future, whatever happened would happen.
Was that song one that you had been performing live?
Yeah.
And how was it received in a club?
Very well. Extremely well, in fact. My audiences at the time, they were into me, and it wasn't, I didn't make a thing out of the song or for that matter the relationship. It just was there, and that is what is so funny, is none of that was ever even discussed with me. You know, it was always just other people. As Richard Vaughn said to me at one time, he said, you'd be amazed how many people want to know about what's going on between he and I. You know, come on, tell us about Troy, you know. And there was nothing to tell. But there was, you know, people. People like to talk, Lord, how they love to talk. You know?
It seems like happiness. Happiness is just a little thing called Joe. Now Joe, he's got a way that makes the lilacs wanna grow. You know, little Joe, he's got a way that makes all the angels heave a sigh when they know that little Joe is passing by.
Sometimes the cabin's gloomy. The table may be a little bare. But then Joe, he'll kiss you. And it's Christmas everywhere. Your troubles fly away. Your life is easy, girl. Now, does a little Joe love you good? Well, that's all. That's all you need to know. You see, your happiness is just a little thing called Joe. Little Joe. Little Joe. Well, that's Joey.
Thank you. Thank you.
Around 1965, Troy released his second full-length album called Gazzaris Presents Troy Walker.
Well, Gazzaris was a club, I take it.
Yeah.
And that album, do you know what year it came out?
Gee, no, I really don't. That album was done, what they did, we went to Capitol Records, and they set up a whole studio like a nightclub. And that album was recorded.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking it had to be at least 1965 because it contains, one of the medleys contains the song 1, 2, 3, which came out that year.
Yeah, I would say it was about that time or else, shortly after. Cause that was just another one we grabbed and threw it in cause I liked it, it's in a medley of tunes, I believe.
Right.
And as it is a studio version of a nightclub, that explains the lack of any audience noise on the recording, which I think is a plus. Let's hear that medley I just referred to, called the Rescue Me Medley, and you tell me it doesn't remind you of Jackie Wilson.
Oh, won't somebody, somebody please. Hold my hand. Come on and rescue me. Hey, somebody please understand my pain. Take away the rain. Bring sunshine in my life. Hey, rescue me.
Everything I did was no joy in you.
song that you've recorded seems to have been the most popular?
I don't know. I really don't know because none of them really went anywhere or did anything. I mean, the Marijuana Munchies, Dr. Demento played it in his program. It was held on for a long time. That was all over the country, but we never put it out.
Let's talk about that while we're on it. That was later. Was that like 77?
Something like that. I'm not really sure.
Okay.
There was a whole era there.
Right. And it was called Marijuana Munchies. Can you tell me about it?
It starts out, I got the Marijuana Munchies, and I can't help myself. I go into the kitchen, and I can eat anything on the shelf. Some burritos, a tostada, it don't matter how much I eat. I never get any fatter. I got the Marijuana Munchies, and I can't help myself. Marijuana Munchies, and I can't help myself. It was a funny song, really. It was, and at the end, where Colonel got ribs, you know. I want a burger. Somebody get me a hamburger. It was kind of a funny thing that we did. And on the other side, I think it's not the end of my world. It's on the other side. I'm not positive. We just put it out there for almost a joke.
A novelty record.
Demento picked it up, and I've gotten more reaction on that. Everywhere I go, they want to hear that, you know, and I didn't know it had done anything because we didn't sell any.
Did you write that song?
No, it was, I co-wrote it with Jay York. He was just a guy that hung around. Actually, how it happened is we were in the studio. We had a rehearsal studio, and we were in there just messing around, and somebody said they were hungry. And I made a statement, you know, you got the Marijuana Munchies, and then he started making up words, and I started making up words, and the engineer just flipped on the switch, and we got a basis for it, and then just put it together. It was a joke. I was making fun of the band.
I got the Marijuana Munchies, and I can't help myself. I go into the kitchen and look. Marijuana Munchies, and I can't help myself. Hey, man, I'm starving. Somebody give me something to eat. Give me
There's a story I read about that you had a run-in with Jerry Lee Lewis.
Did I ever? Yeah, he was going to be performing at the Palomino, and out here, at the time it was the top country nightclub in the country at the time, and I was asked to be his opening act, and I went to work, and he was a bit inebriated, and I guess his daughter had flirted with my guitar player. When I came in, I rounded the corner going into the back to the dressing rooms, and he had two of my people in headlocks, and my piano player's glasses were falling off, and we had quite a little... I did something I probably shouldn't put on the radio, but I told him to let go of my people.
Did you pull did you pull a gun on him?
yes, I did. He had two of my people in the headlock. You know, I had to do what I had to do. He's drunk as a skunk. And I already known that he shot people from stage, you know, and kicked pianos off on people, and he's been pretty rowdy at times. And he said, "Who in the something are you?" And I said, "I'm your opening act, or I was your opening act, Mr. Lewis." And he, grumbled. He had no choice but to let my people go. And he went back into his dressing room, and shortly one of his people came out and said Jerry wanted to talk to me. And I said, screw that, because he had quite a reputation for being a tough guy. And he shot some people from stage. So I was reluctant to go back, but finally did. And he called me a ballsy little so-and-so. And come to find out, his daughter comes walking in and called Jerry a few names and said, he wasn't doing anything with me. I was flirting with him. And she called Jerry names. And anyway, he apologized and told me I was going on. I said, no, I'm not, because I told the boys to pack up. And he went on and introduced me. He said, I've never worked with a dude in a doily, but I want to introduce you to someone that I'm giving my name up to. And he said, here's the killer, Mr. Troy Walker. And I came out, and he, it wound up being a very beautiful thing, because I wound up opening it for him quite a bit. But it didn't start out pretty. Country, soul, and rock and roll, that's another, just reminded myself, another recording of mine where I sing about him. And he got a kick out of it. He asked me to come down to Nashville, work in a club down there. I never went. But it was a good thing that happened between Jerry and I. Except that I think he was quite surprised. The kid in the doily, telling him to let go of my people in the way I did it.
This song you just mentioned, was this something you recorded?
Well, yes. Yeah. That was a real good, country rock. I started singing songs, standing at my daddy's knee. They said I was as cute as could be. Singing Mary Had a Little Lamb, beating on an old frying pan, watching Jerry Lee on my TV. Doing country soul and rock and roll, oh, oh, one night stand at the Hollywood Bowl. It's always been a dream, and I'll feel just like a king doing good old country soul and rock and roll. It was a good song.
Wonderful. I can't wait to hear it.
Singing songs, standing at my daddy's knee. They said I was as cute as could be. Singing Mary Had a Little Lamb, and I was beating on an old frying pan, watching Jerry Lee on my TV. You know the times they have changed, but the people remain the same, and the only claim to fame is rock and roll. Well, keep that jukebox humming, 'cause look out, I'm still coming. Words within me, lift them, please. The country soul, rock and roll, when I stand at the Hollywood Bowl. It's always been my dream, I feel just like a king,
and rock and roll.
I understand you worked for a while with Leon Russell.
Oh, yeah. When I first came to Hollywood, and Leon was just bouncing around town doing different, clubs, and he played piano. My family was quite surprised. We were at Musso Frank's on Hollywood Boulevard. They came in, and my two boys and my nephew were there, and Leon walked in, and he saw me and came clear over and squatted down, and, "Where have you been? What are you doing?" And my family couldn't get their jaws up, you know. I said, "Leon, would you tell them that we did work together for several years?" It was another good moment, you know. He was an extreme talent, and I would go on stage, and I could throw anything at him, and we cut it. In fact, I have a sneaking suspicion, we never discussed it, but I used to do Julie London, her voice, and when we were doing it, I told him, "Leon, let's kick this thing in the behind." And he did the Joe Cocker, "Now you say sorry," you know, and we rocked it out. And I think that's where it came from when Joe put it out. But I don't want to lay a claim to something that was strictly Leon's doing.
And I've read you read around with Cher a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Cher and I ran the streets. In fact, there's one that has a little bit of controversy involved. I recorded What Now My Love with a 21-piece orchestra. And Green and Stone, who I guess were managing Sonny and Cher at the time, came into the studio and, that kid's got some real pipes on him. And they bought, Dave Del Conte, who was producing it with me, sold them the whole thing, and they just lifted my voice off of it, and Sonny and Cher did it.
Version is terrific.
Yes, it is. But it was my version. The whole arrangement was mine, and it was a hell of a recording. And it came out, and they were doing a benefit at the Tiger nightclub, and I went. Sonny and Cher were there, and I walked over Cher, and I said, "It's about your recording." I said, "Yeah. You know, that was my record." She didn't know. Cher didn't know that had been done. And she asked Sonny, and I guess it was a little bit of a burr flu, because she got angry that they had taken my voice off. And that's done in Hollywood, I guess, quite a bit, but I didn't know anything about it, and she didn't either. But we recorded that at Gold Star.
Since you mentioned Gold Star, did you run into Phil Spector?
Oh, did I ever? I shouldn't. The Teddy Bears, way back, To Know Him Is to Love Him.
Yep.
Way back then, I ran into Phil Spector. I was running around with Marshall Leib, who was one of the Teddy Bears. And, I ran into Phil Spector.
You got to tell me. You got to tell me the story.
No, there's some things that I could have raised that controversy a long time ago, but it has no place. I don't want the tag. You know what I mean?
Okay.
I just don't want the tag because it was a strange scene. But to know him is to love him has a very unique bridge. Okay?
Right.
Yeah.
And you contributed that, and they took it.
No, I didn't contribute. They were coming up with the sound, I guess. And I suggested it, and I guess Marshall took it back in. And Phil, of course, he was busy shooting somebody. I don't know. I never cared for him very much. There's several reasons. You know, Darlene Love was a dear friend, and he did a lot of people wrong. You know, for lack, that's my opinion. You know, he did a lot of good friends. Really did him wrong.
I used to say that I really admired his talent, but I wouldn't want to have lunch with him.
And not at all. I wouldn't want to even talk to him. You know, what I know and what I saw, he wasn't. I've seen him. I've seen the threats. I've seen him pull the gun. I've seen him make demands that were unreasonable. But mainly, I've seen him take great talents and
bury them.
Bury them. You use the word, sir. You use the word. Yeah, what he did with Darlene was very sad.
Yeah, I do know that story.
I have no respect.
In the 60s and 70s, did you run around with any gay entertainers?
In the 60s and 70s, no, I didn't. I really wasn't running with anybody. I was just busy, you know, seven nights a week, every night, doing a different club somewhere.
Did you know Johnny Ray?
I met Johnny Ray. In fact, he's the only person that ever said anything to me, critiquing me, that sort of blew me away, because I went to a party. I admire Johnny. I liked the voice. And I was doing a party for him. I was playing at a party for him, and I was singing his songs, and he came out in a robe and walked around the piano looking at me, and I just kept singing. When I stopped, he says, I'm a has-been, and you're mediocre. And I fell out, you know. I mean, it sort of blew my mind. It kind of hurt my feelings, but not really. You know, what is that? But when I thought about it later on, it was kind of a, you know, slam, since he had recorded with Timmy, and then they couldn't even do anything with the record, and she couldn't stand him. You know, she said that it was a weak shot. But I personally always highly admired him. And when I met him, it was not disappointing, but yeah, disappointing. That's a good enough word, I guess.
I was going to comment that I saw Johnny Ray once in person. It was in 1980. I was in L.A. on vacation. I was in a gay bar, and he was in the bar, and somebody I was talking to said, "You see that guy over there? That's Johnny Ray." And he was obviously drunk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was drunk whenever I met him. He was drunk, and Timmy said when they brought him in to record, I believe, with her, that he was drunk. And she said she had a terrible time recording with him.
Every time I hear a newborn baby cry, then I know why I believe.
You know, the man, what can I tell you? I guess he put more of his life out than he should have, but he was, as far as I'm concerned, he was an incredible, innovative, star. It's a shame that he had to put his personal life out like it did, like he did, and he got in a lot of, you know, had a lot of problems that way. But a legend is a legend, and he certainly, certainly
right.
was one, and one that I highly admired as growing up. You asked me my influences earlier as a singer. He was one of them. In fact, the first song I did, that I ever sang, period, in front of an audience was at, in the High School Follies. I did Cry, and just tore the place up, you know, doing it. I highly admired him. I did.
Talking about Johnny Ray, you said he put more of his personal life out there than he should have. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, didn't he get caught in a motel room or something or other? Yeah, it was way back. But I remember I read in some paper that he had been caught with a Marine involved in gay performance, I guess, or homosexual performance.
Was he openly gay?
I don't know whether he was openly gay, but I mean, everybody seemed to think so. So I know there was a scandal involved with him somewhere, that he had been involved and gotten in some kind of trouble, and it really hurt his career.
As a postscript, I did some research after our talk and found that Johnny Ray had been arrested twice within a few months in Detroit for soliciting male vice cops. This was in 1951 when his career was first skyrocketing, and while still very popular, it must have hurt him with the public a little. Remember, this was 5 years before many were scandalized by the stage performances of Elvis.
Do you think you ever experienced discrimination professionally for being gay?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Not overt. They wouldn't say that, but I've walked in with a husband and wife owner, and she was making comments of, you know, I'm not going to put that on our stage, and different partners. Yeah, I've had some of that, but you know, it's never, I could care less, you know. It never, you know, bothered me to the point of doing anything, but I might get a little indignant, but that's, they'll always be that. Even with labels, you know, going to different labels, nobody knew nothing, but there was always jibber jabber talk, you know. That sort of thing went on. One time, I can't remember who the columnist was, if you're looking for a gay evening, things like that. Nothing spectacular. But if it was discrimination, it was kind of behind closed doors. They didn't come out directly at me. A couple times it did, but nothing that, you know, was earth-shaking. And one time, even Shindig, I think it was, one of those shows, the one that had Bobby Sherman. What was that show?
Shindig or Hullabaloo.
Yeah, one of the two. I was in the side room, and Wink Martindale and Jimmy O'Neill and Bob Eubanks, and they were all talking, and the suggestion was that they get me for the show. You know, Troy can sing anything, blah, 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 blah. And the comment was made that I was gay and a little out there. And when I walked in the room, the person that said it, oh, Troy, we were just talking about you. How you doing? I was aware of what was said, you know, and I kind of got a little indignant there. Yeah, I know what you think, you know. And they kind of walked out of that little meeting.
Were you on those shows?
No. They were considering me for that show.
Did you sing on television?
Yeah, I did. I guess I did a couple times. But it was usually for benefits for Jerry's kids, that sort of thing, you know.
Are there any questions I should ask that I haven't asked yet?
Yeah, I really don't know. I don't know what I would even have to offer. Say, I don't find myself.
Well, I've been entertained for the last hour.
you sound like Johnny Whiteside. He's really a one hell of a guy, by the way. And he's had a great deal to do with kind of making me want to go back.
He doesn't know that, but he really has.
Yeah, well, this has been a treat for me. I've been wanting to track you down for years, and until Johnny Whiteside mentioned on his page that you did a show, that was the first person I found that I could ask, hey, this person may know how to get a hold of you.
I'll be darned.
So otherwise, I wouldn't have had any way to connect.
This is J.D. Doyle, and I thank you for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed this very unique visit with Troy Walker. You can find out more information on my site at queermusicheritage.com, where I've compiled a lot of photos of him over the years. Down to the last song, and since I noticed Troy recorded the song No Regrets twice, I just had to ask him about it.
Is that one of your most popular songs? Because it's on both of your albums.
Yeah, it was my closing song. It's I closed with it. It was because it was done by Edith Piaf originally, and it was very inspirational because with all the heartache in her life, she did sang No Regrets, and it was sort of, you know, registered with her, and it registered very much with me and my audiences. It was a closer for a lot of the shows.
The only way to have a truly fair election is if everyone votes. Get involved and make your vote count. Ballots for the 2010 local station board were mailed the week of August 15th. A separate mailing that includes information on all the candidates will be mailed the week of August 22nd. Tune in to KPFT every morning from August 23rd to August 27th from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. and hear the candidates speak about their ideas for KPFT. Join us on Sunday, August 29th from 3 p.m. to 6 p.m. for the first of two community candidate forums. Both will be located at the Houston Institute for Culture at 708C Telephone Road. For more details, go to www.kpft.org. Keep KPFT healthy and thriving. Vote.
This is local station board candidate David Stahl. As a listener member, I know the power of KPFT as a platform for free speech. I enjoy our diversity of music and the open dialogue. I applaud our locally produced programs and talented hosts, and I value programming that's free of corporate advertising. As a member like you, I want to do more to support our community radio, and with your help, I can. You can put my proven activist skills and experience to work for KPFT. Let me join our team of outstanding board members to ensure KPFT remains on the air for another 40 years, fulfilling its mission as Radio for Peace. Please put David Stahl